Good morning.
Good morning.
There we go. All right. Well, today we are finishing our last Sunday in the series on Meals with Jesus. We've spent the past 5 weeks looking at meals in the Gospel of Luke, as Luke uses these as primary points in, as he recounts the events of Jesus' life to talk about how when Jesus was sitting down, eating with people, he used that very relational time to teach them and to show them many things about himself and what he desires of them. We've looked at meals as enacted grace, community, hope, mission, and last week was a big one, the Last Supper. The meal that most people know the most about in Luke's gospel. As Jesus and just the 12 disciples, not all the disciples, met together in an upper room and they observed the Passover feast as they each had done their entire life. As they were recounting and remembering when God had brought the Israelites out of Egypt, he had rescued them and redeemed them. And it was a Passover like every other Passover, until it wasn't. Because Jesus changed things. He broke the bread, and he connected that to his body that would soon be broken. And he took the wine, and he connected that to his blood that would soon be shed. And the 12 disciples have been learning from him for years, 3 years, and they have learned so much. And they still did not get things, because what he was talking about was beyond their wildest imagination. They had no category, no concept, no way to really get what was about to happen. That was the meal we looked at last week. The meal we're looking at today occurs just a few days later. But a lot has happened in those few days. Shortly after the Last Supper, Jesus is arrested. And he goes through this farce of a trial, and he is sentenced to death. And they torture him, and they crucify him. And some of the disciples flee because they're terrified. They don't understand. They're afraid they're next. And Jesus dies. And they pierce his side with a sword to verify he is dead before they bring him down. And they bury him before the Sabbath on Friday. And he's in the tomb on Saturday and then Sunday morning. And our story picks up a little bit later on Sunday. These two travelers from our gospel account probably left Jerusalem sometime around noon-ish. They were headed to Emmaus 7 miles away, which walking an average pace with the terrain would take about 2.5 hours. They left after they had heard of the events of that morning, or some of the events that morning. They knew the tomb was empty. If you were here last week when Jed was talking about the Last Supper, you'll know that he also peeked ahead a little bit into today's meal, and he talked a little bit about the Emmaus meal. And he showed us that wonderful painting by Rembrandt, I think. Yes, I'm getting a head nod. By Rembrandt. That right there will tell you how much I know about paintings. I love paintings. I can look at them and say, this is beautiful, and I love it when he uses them to connect it to the events and help us understand things. But paintings are not a natural way for me to connect with. And I'm popping a lot. Sorry. It's just not. I don't typically choose to go to museums where you have this type of art. I find it beautiful, but I don't want to spend that long doing that. I will look at a picture on the internet and I'm content. That's how cultured I am. But a couple of years ago, I had a chance to go to the Vatican Museum. And even though I'm not typically a museum person, when you get a chance to go, you go. And I loved it. It was wonderful. I was there for, I think, 5 hours, which was in many ways an eternity. It was wonderful. And of course, near the end, you get the Sistine Chapel, which is what you really are going to see. And by the time I'm walking out of the Sistine Chapel, it is just so much. I am overwhelmed. Everything is beautiful. I don't understand half of what I should when I look at the paintings. I just know they're beautiful. And I walk out, and I am ready to be done. I am tired. I am exhausted. For at least an hour before I got into the Sistine Chapel, you're herded like cattle because so many people are trying to get into the Sistine Chapel. So by the time I'm walking out of the chapel, I don't want to see another person for a year. It was just too much. I was tired. I was exhausted. And I was expecting to walk out of the chapel and be near the exit so I could escape and relax. But you're not. They don't warn you about this, no matter how much you look on the internet to find out the structure of everything, because I'm that type of planner, I still had many hallways to walk through that had more art in them. And at this point, I didn't care anymore. I was tired. And I'm walking out, and I'm vaguely looking. I'm just like, where is the exit? I'm exhausted. And I'm just plowing my way out of the museum until I suddenly stopped. Because even though I don't typically connect to paintings, even for people like me, sometimes a painting just strikes you. And I encountered one. It's not a painting about the Emmaus Road gospel story, but I think it can help us orient ourselves to the account. And it is a painting by Vincent Iroli. If we could put this up. This picture of the painting does not do it justice. I can't explain what's going on in this picture except to say when I look at this, I feel the grief. I feel the loss of hope, the distraughtness. This is the emotion that the disciples were in on Sunday morning. Our two travelers were disciples of Jesus. They weren't the 12, but they were some of his disciples. This depicts, I think, where they were at emotionally, what they were feeling. They had lost hope. They didn't understand. Their friend was dead, but more than that, their Messiah was dead. And how can a dead person be the Messiah, the one to come and redeem? When I think of these two travelers walking on this road, I think of this. Maybe they were at the cross and saw this. Maybe they saw his dead body. Maybe there were some who couldn't be there because they were afraid. But regardless, they knew what happened. And they did not know what to do. And so Sunday morning, they hear the news that some women had gone to the tomb and the body is not there. And they claim these angels told them he's alive. Some of the other disciples went to the tomb and saw it empty. They didn't see the angels. And this is all that these two travelers know. They're lost and they're confused and they have questions. I imagine their walk as they're trying to figure it out. They were walking together, talking about what had happened, and I can just imagine their confusion as they're trying to piece together the pieces to this puzzle, but they don't have the image on the box. They don't understand how these things come together. And in my imagination, as they're walking, I hear one of them say, "Do you remember when he fed the 5,000 and he broke the bread and the things he said? He's the Messiah, right?" And the other one responding, I know, I remember that, but we saw the spear in his side. How? And I can just imagine them wrestling with it in the really the way I would wrestle with it. I think we all would. The pieces don't make sense. And as they're caught up in their questions, their doubt, their grief, this stranger who's walking on the road just interrupts them. I'm convinced that Jesus has a sense of humor. They don't recognize him, and we're not told why, but they don't. And he comes and he just asks them, "Hey, what are you talking about?" And one of them, we only know the name of one of them, it's Cleopas. He's very shocked. "How do you not know? Are you the only person who's been in Jerusalem these 3 days and you don't know? How? How do you not know?" The only thing I can connect this to that is the same level of incredulity was back in the COVID year when everybody was watching that Netflix show, The Tiger King. If you encountered somebody who had not even heard of it, you were confused. How have you not heard of it? I get not wanting to watch it, but you haven't heard. And it's just that level of how. And Jesus just responds with, "Well, what are you talking about? What things? What happened?" And these two respond. And they tell him, "Well, Jesus of Nazareth." And what they respond to Jesus with tells us a lot about their questions. They recognize him as a prophet, somebody from God who is acting on God's behalf, speaking for God. He had powerful words. They didn't just sound good. They were powerful. There was something about his words, and he could do things that nobody else could do, healing people. But the chief priests had him killed. And not just that. It's not just that he was a good man. It's not just that he was a prophet. We thought he was the Messiah, the one who would redeem Israel. And we know these people have said the tomb is empty, but we just can't figure it out. And this is where I wish we had a bit more than we have. Because when we have words on a page, we don't have any indication of the tone. And so our translation for Jesus' response says, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken." The tone in which you hear this changes drastically what he's saying. Because if he said this, "Oh, you are so foolish, how are you so slow to understand?" it would be demeaning and really condemning. I don't hear the words in that tone. From what we see of Jesus, yes, there are times he chides his disciples. He's like, "Come on, guys." But it's always a welcoming, especially when we see what Jesus does next as he takes time. Remember, it's a 2.5-hour journey at least to Emmaus. Perhaps he joined them pretty soon after they left Jerusalem, and you have at least 2 hours. I hear his words here with a slight smile in his voice because he knows. He knows they're about to see the full picture, and he's excited. And perhaps also a little bit of turning the tables on Cleopas, who just said, "How do you not know?" And Jesus turning the tables and saying, "You still don't get it, do you? You're having trouble believing the prophets." I would give anything to know what was said after this for those 2 hours. It says, Luke tells us that he went through Moses and all the prophets. And he explained to them these pieces of the puzzle and how they fit together. 2 hours-ish of having Jesus himself, although they don't know that yet, explain to them how these things work. How the pieces come together. Moses and the prophets, he's using all of the Old Testament, all of the Hebrew Bible. the prophets that you can think of their names of and the prophets that you right now cannot think of their names because we don't talk about them that often. Or they're so random that they just don't come to mind. He's using that. He probably used Leviticus too, you know, the book we're afraid of, kind of. Because it's a lot, and we need help. It's not our context, sacrifices. Perhaps some of the passages that were read earlier are ones that he used. They're two that we commonly use to talk about Messiah in the Old Testament. Psalms 2. That psalm that begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? I think he probably did use this psalm because that first line is what Jesus said when he was on the cross, which would draw this psalm to your mind for the Israelites who knew the scriptures. Perhaps he walked through that psalm that we read portions of, and he talked about the description in there. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them. And he walked them through how that is exactly what happened on Friday. And he walked them through potentially more of the verses in that psalm. And then you get to this one verse that hits at the point of their questions and doubt, where it says, and all nations will bow down before him. But you don't bow down before a dead person. Perhaps Isaiah 53, one of the many passages that we call the servant songs as they're talking about the Messiah. Maybe he used the verses from that said, he was pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. And he talked again about the prophecy of Christ's death. The Messiah had to die. And then you get further down, and it hits at the issue that they have, this thing that did not make sense, where it says in verse 11, after he has suffered, he will see the light of life. Dead people don't see, and they don't see the light of life. Perhaps these are some of the passages he used as he's helping them take the pieces they have and bring them together. And for perhaps 2 hours or so, they're talking on the road to Emmaus. And then they get there, and they beg Jesus to come in. They do not want this conversation to stop. Something about what he is saying, as we find out a little bit later in the passage, made their hearts burn. There was something. And they keep talking as they're preparing food, and they're putting it on the table. And these two disciples are sitting there at a table with food and Jesus. And Jesus takes the bread, and he thanks it, and he breaks it. These are not two disciples who were in the upper room. They didn't see that Passover connection, but at that moment, it connected. At that moment, their eyes were open, and they realized that this was not a stranger. This was their promise alive and breathing before them, who had been talking with them. The promise that they thought was gone was alive. The promise was there. And in a way that kind of honestly confuses me, I'm like, why'd you do it this way? I don't know. He disappears. Our series is about meals with Jesus, but honestly, I don't think this meal was eaten. He breaks the bread. They realize he disappears. Imagine just what they were feeling and thinking at that moment when the pieces came together fully. Perhaps they managed to grab a little bit of food as they hightail it back to Jerusalem. I believe their trip back to Jerusalem took a record low amount of time for them to get back because they're so excited. They go back and they find the disciples, and the disciples are together, and they still haven't seen. They're stuck in the same questions and doubt that these two travelers had been. And they begin telling them everything. He's alive. We have seen them. These disciples are just like the two disciples were at the beginning of our story. They're not going to immediately believe. They have already heard people say that he's not dead. They don't know how to put these pieces together yet. Our story continues past our passage reading today, and as these two disciples are talking with Jesus, talking to the disciples about Jesus, suddenly Jesus appears in their midst. And again, I'm convinced Jesus has a sense of humor in how this is carried out. I imagine him just enjoying this because he's seeing them put the pieces together. He appears. The two who had already seen him, I imagine, are just ecstatic. He's there again. And these other disciples, they're not quite there just yet. They can't process. They think maybe he's a ghost. And Jesus is telling them, he's meeting them in their doubt. And he's like, no, this is me. You can touch me. Here's my hands. The scars, like, I am me. And the reason I'm convinced he has a little bit of a sense of humor here is as this is going on and people are trying to comprehend, he just turns to one of them and says, do you have any food? And they give him a piece of fish. And he eats it. And at that moment, they realize he is real. We know this piece of fish is real. Perhaps they had been sitting at a table themselves. And he eats it. And not only did he show them that he is real, but what he had done with the two disciples on the road, as he explained to them from Scripture, all these pieces and how they fit together, he does that again with all of these disciples now. He explains to them from Moses, through the prophets and the Psalms, what the pieces are that he had been teaching them for 3 years. And now that they have this final reality that they cannot deny, that they now know in a way they could not comprehend before, he explains it again. Their promise that they had been hoping for was made real at these tables. And one of the things, or really the thing I love most about these stories, is that Jesus met them. Sorry, fly. Jesus met them in their questions and their doubt. These two disciples walking along the way, they are lost, they are confused, and he meets them and he teaches them, he helps them. And then later with the other disciples, same thing. He takes the time to meet them in their questions. And at the table in Luke's gospel, we see the promise become a reality. And we also see that the promise is not threatened by our questions. The promise is not threatened by our doubts. He welcomes them. He takes the time to answer the questions. When we come together in a little while for the table, we don't walk up here leaving any questions and doubts we have behind. We don't set them on the chair beside us and come forward pretending that we've got it all, that we understand everything, we understand the promises. We don't do that. When we come forward to receive the bread, we come forward with our questions, with our doubts. And let's be honest, we all have questions and doubts, and they're different. Perhaps some of us in the room today, our questions are more along the line of these two disciples and the other disciples. Did he really come back to life? Really? Perhaps your questions are very different. Perhaps your questions are, is God really asking me to do this? Is God really asking me to take these steps in this relationship? Because I don't know. I don't think I can do that. I doubt I can do that. Your questions and your doubts are not to be feared. They do not threaten God. They do not threaten his promise. His promise is his promise, and he meets us at the table as we carry our questions. And perhaps in some way, by coming and participating, God is going to answer your questions that way. Perhaps he wants you to sit at a table with others in the church and ask your questions and share your doubts that way. And that's how he's going to meet them. There are many different ways that he meets us in our questions and our doubts. But don't try to pretend that you don't have them. I have mine. You have yours. And they are welcomed at his table. And that is one of the beautiful things about his promise. If you would please stand for the prayers of the people.